what is the Constitution? How would you define it?
A list of laws that are above the remainder of the laws and that govern what the rest of the laws can be.
I would say like the like main laws, like people's rights and stuff.
Constitution would be nationally rights of the citizens and the individuals involved.
I suppose it's like a set of rules and regulations.
Yeah.
Like for the country.
How much do you know about the Constitution? If you'd run into me and my microphone in Cork the other day, would you have been able to define it or tell me what's in it? Or even if you've read it? Have you ever read the Constitution?
No.
Have you ever read the Constitution?
No.
Have you ever read the Constitution?
I have not.
Have you ever read the Constitution?
No.
Do you know any of your constitutional rights?
Not particularly, no.
I have the right to... Oh, God.
Could you name any of your constitutional rights?
No.
This isn't America, so not the right to bear arms, as much fun as that would be. Right not to be mugged while walking home at night, that kind of the way.
Freedom of religion, freedom of expression, I think. Right to own property, is that one? And I think all of them are curbed by, unless the government says so, by like this, whatever some reasonable person would say is appropriate, or something like that, some stupid clause.
Do you think the Constitution is important?
Yeah, it is. But like, obviously it doesn't protect everyone.
Well, I think it's important that we do have that set of like rules to the way the country runs.
Like, it's a set of rules, so like, you know, it's just like a foundation of what everyone should stand for, and yeah.
Do you think the Constitution is important?
Yeah. There's no question asked about that.
Yeah.
Yes.
We all know that there is a little book called The Constitution, and most people would agree that it's pretty important, even though it also seems like most people haven't read it. The Irish Constitution, or Bunreacht na hÉireann, is the fundamental legal document that sets out how Ireland should be governed and the rights of its citizens. It lays down the basic rules, or Bunreacht, that sit at the top of the legal system, and all other laws have to comply with the Constitution. You might ask then, if those in charge of running the country have to answer to the Constitution, who's in charge of the Constitution itself? The answer is everyone. You, me, we the people. When he presented the first draft of today's Constitution to the Dáil in 1937, Éamon de Valera said, "If there's one thing more than another that is clear and shining through this whole Constitution, it is the fact that the people are the masters." The first few lines of the Constitution itself say that we, the people of Éire, adopt, enact, and give to ourselves this Constitution. But how much do we, the people, even know about our Constitution? What's in it? How does it work? And how can we use it? I'm going to be speaking to three constitutional experts to learn more about the little book that is the bedrock of our society. Campaigner Alva Smith will talk us through the journey to achieving a referendum, and Professor Conor O'Mahony of UCC will be explaining how not all constitutional rights are actually written in the Constitution. But first, I'm joined by practising barrister Nora Neilinchig, who's going to explain how you actually go about defending your constitutional rights in court. Firstly, what I want to ask you, Nora, is suppose I'm a person who thinks that their constitutional rights have been breached in some way and I want to take action. What would be my first port of call?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think it's actually in some ways a slightly tricky question to answer, because the Constitution itself, as anyone who has ever looked at it, and you can, if you don't have a physical copy, you can always go online. It's on there as PDF, I think, on the Department of the Taoiseach website. You can always get the up-to-date version. But going to the document itself actually mightn't get you the answer. So you may be none the wiser having had a look at it. You know, the Constitution itself is less than 200 pages long, and that's in two different languages. And kind of the main constitutional textbook, Kelly on the Constitution, which is kind of the leading book, that's over 2,000 pages long, and the font is tiny. So what I would say about it is that the kind of what the book itself says and what is out there on it is, you know, there's a huge kind of gap between the two. if you're somebody who wakes up in the morning and you think, look, there might have been a breach of my rights either has happened or is happening, then, I mean, there are, you know, some websites that are out there that are quite useful that I think can kind of give people a sense of things. I know the Supreme Court has kind of updated their website a little bit. Citizens Information is generally quite good on legal rights. And, you know, there are kind of public, but I would steer away from the message boards. That's one thing I would say, because I think certainly I have seen, you know, I would sometimes meet clients and they would have an idea about something and you'd say, no, that's an American kind of concept. That's not, we don't have that in Ireland. But I mean, the first port of call, if you do think you have a serious legal problem, is probably going to be going to a solicitor. And they may come to someone like me, go to a barrister and say, well, look, this is what's going on. What do you think?
Okay, so then I've done my research, maybe gotten some professional legal advice, and I still think I have a case. So what's next? Do I storm the steps of the Supreme Court?
We often think of kind of, you know, somebody like that example of somebody waking up saying, hold on a second, my constitutional rights have been breached. And you kind of go to your solicitor and you kind of charge into court. And if that is the case, you're probably charging into the High Court. So it's the kind of the main court that any kind of constitutional challenge in that sense will go into, because it's the first court in that structure of courts that could actually strike something down and say that a law is unconstitutional or say that your rights have been breached. Whereas the courts that are lower down, the district court and the circuit court, wouldn't have the same kind of power or jurisdiction as what we would call it. Constitutional rights and people's constitutional rights are invoked, you know, elsewhere as well, apart from the kind of the grandiose settings of the High Court. But if you are somebody that is bringing a kind of a challenge to a law, let's say, that's saying it's unconstitutional, you'll probably begin in the High Court. And you can't really begin any higher than that. You have to start in the High Court. So I think sometimes there can be a perception that, oh, if I have a serious constitutional case, then I must go to the Supreme Court. But unfortunately, no one gets directly into the Supreme Court. You have to start off in the High Court. Sometimes you can go directly on appeal to the Supreme Court, but only if you can show the court and demonstrate that you have a particular public interest point or a particular constitutional point. Otherwise, you have to go High Court, Court of Appeal, and then Supreme Court. So it can be a long road to get to the final destination of the Supreme Court.
When you actually get to court then for a constitutional case, there's a certain balancing act that judges are doing, which means it's not quite as cut and dry as you might expect. And to talk about that, we're going to use the example of the pandemic. There are people in society who have challenged public health guidelines as a breach of their constitutional rights. Have you seen many of these cases, Nora, coming through the courts?
On the kind of the big challenges front, big all guns blazing, I'm going into court, this whole system is unconstitutional. And so we've had a number of those, but a lot of them, those kind of challenges, I should say, but they haven't really gotten off the ground.
And why haven't these cases gotten off the ground? There are rights in the constitution, like your right to travel, which have been limited by lockdowns. Is that not enough to win a case?
Sometimes we think of rights as being, and this is something that some academics talk about, like a trump card, that, you know, like, well, I have my right and I can play that card and, you know, that will be of, you know, then I'll win. But it's a much more complicated picture in practice. And constitutional rights are, none of them are limitless. There are very few rights that aren't subjected to some form of limitation. I think the one example we sometimes give is the right to be protected from torture is one of the only rights that has no limitations. But almost all other constitutional rights have limits. And so they can be limited both by other rights, and they might be competing as against other rights. But often, and what happens more regularly, is that in fact constitutional rights are limited by other objectives or other values. For any kind of court analysing a breach of constitutional rights or a potential breach of constitutional rights, one of the things that they're going to be looking at is whether there is what's called proportionality in terms of the restriction on rights. So this is an idea that the courts sometimes use, I suppose, it's a lens by which they look at breaches of rights. And so they will be saying, well, what's the objective to be achieved in this restriction? So in this legislation, for example, what are we trying to do? What is the government trying to achieve? Is there another way that this could be done which restricts rights less? And is there, you know, is there a kind of a rational connection between the objective and the means? And they kind of tend to form part of what's called a proportionality kind of analysis or test. And so when we think about the pandemic, what's the objective we're trying to achieve? okay, serious public health issues arise, we're trying to maintain life, we're trying to maintain health. You know, they are very kind of weighty objectives to be achieved. Mm-hmm. And so the next question then, I suppose, that any court faced with some of this is going to be looking at, well, is there a way that we could restrict rights less in aiming for that, in getting that objective? And I think, so I think that is what comes into play when you're talking about the rights being restricted, and really whether you're going to have a successful kind of case or not is really going to go to that question.
Yeah. So far then, public health objectives have been extremely weighty and difficult to outweigh with any one person's individual rights. But could you foresee any future rights cases arising out of the pandemic which might be successful?
I think that's quite a good question, and I think that it will depend to an extent on how things are managed, particularly from now onwards, because if you think about that important objective of kind of maintaining life, making sure the health system isn't overwhelmed and so on, you have those objectives and they have been very strong and very weighty to date. But if we start to look at a situation in the coming months where more and more people are vaccinated, it seems like the health service may not become overwhelmed, then a court looking at a challenge will be really looking at that second kind of question about, well, is there a less restrictive way to achieve this objective? Can this be done in a manner that protects rights better? And so I think you may well have a case where, if there are still very blunt restrictions, if I could put it that way, that somebody says, well, look, there is a way to do this that would restrict my rights less, and that might be a more successful route.
Most people are aware that their fundamental rights are written in the Constitution. But what you might not know is that there's a whole family of constitutional rights which are not written down in the text itself. These are called unenumerated rights. And although they're not printed in the Constitution, they have made a huge imprint on Irish society. Here to tell us more about them is Professor Conor O'Mahony from UCC, an expert in constitutional law. Conor, tell us, what exactly are unenumerated rights?
If you were to pick up the Irish Constitution and go looking for certain rights, you wouldn't find them in there. And you might think that means they're not protected. But it isn't as simple as that. So the idea of unenumerated rights, which is a word that maybe isn't used much in everyday language, refers to rights which aren't listed, they're not enumerated in the text of the Constitution. So there's quite a number of these rights, around 20 in total. Different people counted differently, but about 20 rights over the years, which the courts have found are protected by the Irish Constitution, even though it doesn't make express reference to them anywhere in the text. And so that process of reading things into the text or reading between the lines is a really critical part of understanding the Constitution and understanding the scope of protection given to rights by the document.
So these rights weren't written into the Constitution in 1937 or inserted by a referendum, but were interpreted by the courts. Does that mean that they're weaker than other rights?
That's a really good question. In principle, no. In principle, it shouldn't matter whether the right is express or unenumerated. But that's in principle. In practice, it can sometimes be the case that because unenumerated rights are identified by the courts through interpretation, that means that they're maybe a bit more malleable than your rights which are expressly written in the Constitution. And there's more scope maybe for the courts to read in limitations or exceptions to them than there might be in the case of the rights which are expressly protected.
Despite that, though, there have been unenumerated rights that have really had a big impact on Irish society. Could you give us an example of one of them?
I think the one that really stands out over the years is the right to privacy. So the right to privacy is a right which everybody would automatically assume that we have. But amazingly, it's not expressly protected in the Irish Constitution. It's an example, as I mentioned earlier, that if you went looking for it, you wouldn't find it. And we've seen over the years that has thrown up some particularly significant unenumerated rights cases. Probably the best known of those would be the McGee case in the early 1970s. But that was the case in which the law prohibiting contraceptives was found to be unconstitutional, and ultimately that was based on the recognition of this new unenumerated right to marital privacy. And, you know, without the recognition of that right and without that case, it may have been a long time thereafter before we would have seen the liberalisation of the laws on contraceptives. It also had an enormous knock-on impact because in some ways that decision was a sort of catalyst for the subsequent enactment of the Eighth Amendment prohibiting abortion, because people in Ireland from the pro-life perspective saw the pattern which had arisen in the US, where a Supreme Court decision in the US around contraceptives ultimately led then to Roe v. Wade, which was their decision on abortion. And so the pro-life lobby in Ireland, seeing what happened in the McGee case, then decided to lobby and ultimately successfully campaign to introduce the Eighth Amendment. So the McGee case was hugely influential, both on the one hand in liberalising the law on contraceptives, but also as something which had an unforeseen consequence of introducing a very restrictive abortion regime for a very long time thereafter. But then that right to marital privacy in McGee was then expanded out in later cases to a general right to privacy, and again led to a number of very significant decisions. A very well-known one would be the Norris decision, in which the right to privacy was used to try and invalidate the law criminalising homosexual conduct between males. That was unsuccessful on that particular occasion. Subsequently, the Kennedy decision was a case in which journalists whose phones had been wiretapped by the Haughey government at the time, they successfully claimed that that wiretapping was a breach of their right to privacy. And that, I guess, leads in then to the much more modern day concerns around privacy. You know, there's so much in a modern day context around our communications, around our online activity and everything else. That raises very significant concerns and questions about privacy. And so the right to privacy is obviously critical in that respect. And so the McGee decision and the recognition of an unenumerated right to privacy, as you can see, it has a very long reach, and it gets mm-hmm. itself involved in a whole host of things which have happened in the 40 years since that decision.
Listening there to the domino effect of establishing an unenumerated right to marital privacy, it would seem like unenumerated rights are a great idea and a great way to push the development of rights in general forward. If I was inspired and I wanted to establish a new unenumerated right, how would I go about it? Could I even go about it?
Well, you could, but it's not easy. And there are a number of reasons why it's not easy. First of all, not just anybody can take a case like that. And there's a principle that in order to take a constitutional case to the courts on anything, you have to be able to show that you're personally affected by the issue at hand. It's a rule known as standing. So you can't take a kind of a hypothetical case, or you can't take a case on behalf of somebody else. You'd have to show that your own interests are at stake. You'd then have to formulate a legal argument as to why an unenumerated right should be recognised. And within that, I guess one of the important considerations there would be whether there's a need to recognise a new unenumerated right. So, you know, could your case be dealt with under an existing right, either express or unenumerated? And then you'd also have to come up with a pretty persuasive argument, in the sense that we've seen a pattern in recent years where the courts, having gone through a phase of recognizing a lot of new unenumerated rights with great enthusiasm for a long time, subsequently became much more reluctant to do so.
Why is that? Surely anyone would be in favor of more rights.
There was an element of caution that came into the practice of the courts, where there had been a lot of criticism that judges were making laws and not just interpreting laws, and that they were stepping outside of their role in doing so. So when you have a referendum and you amend the constitution, that is seen as a very legitimate process because it's democratic and because everybody gets to have their say and gets to have their input. And there's value to that. There's value in the durability that is associated with change, in which everybody got to have their say. On the flip side, if something is done by unelected judges in a process where almost nobody gets to have a say other than the direct litigants in the case, that is seen as less legitimate. And there are a lot of question marks around the process through which judges decide which rights should be recognised or which rights shouldn't be recognised. You know, what sort of sources are they looking to? So that's the big disadvantage of it. And that's why we saw the courts becoming much more cautious. So from the mid 1990s on, the courts almost completely disengaged from unenumerated rights and didn't recognize, well, the Supreme Court didn't recognize any new unenumerated rights for a lengthy period of time from about 1996 up to very, very recently. Since about 2017, there's been a slight hint of a reinvigoration of the doctrine. You know, we can't say with certainty which way the future is going to go, but I think it's a very interesting juncture in the development of this whole idea of unenumerated rights.
Looking to the future then, if the doctrine of unenumerated rights does perhaps make a comeback, are there any rights in particular that you would like to see recognised?
One of the things about unenumerated rights is that there's an element of them responding to the sort of pressing needs of the time. And it is this idea of a last resort, and where you see the political system maybe repeatedly failing on a particular issue, that maybe invites a little bit more in the way of judicial intervention. So I think if you look at the issues which we are likely to face and the big challenges coming down the road for society in the years to come, environmental challenges are certainly right up there. The homelessness crisis and the whole housing issue, which is so pressing, you know, again, raises questions about what might potentially happen in that space. The other space that I think is worth keeping an eye on is direct provision, because we've already seen in 2017 a big decision of the Supreme Court applying the unenumerated right to work in the direct provision context and striking down the law which prohibited people in direct provision from working. So again, direct provision raises a lot of rights concerns, not just the right to work. If we were to see the political system failing to progress the proposals to reform or abolish direct provision, then again, I think that's a space where potentially unenumerated rights arguments might have a role to play.
Weighing everything we've talked about up then, Connor, do you think that unenumerated rights are effective or even a good idea?
Personally, I do. My position has always been that there is an important role for the Constitution to play in addressing rights claims where all else has failed. And it's not to say that the judges should be first into the fray. It's not to say that people should abandon the political course of action in trying to address their grievances. But at the same time, we do know that there are certain individuals or certain groups in society or certain issues which don't lend themselves necessarily to a political solution. And I think in circumstances where the political system is clearly failing to address an issue, I do think there is a role to be played by a very cautious and limited usage of something like the doctrine of unenumerated rights.
So we've looked at the practicalities of defending our constitutional rights in court. We've looked at our unwritten, unenumerated rights. And finally now we're going to look at how we the people can change what's written in our constitution. Alva Smith is a campaigner who was central to both the marriage equality and abortion referenda campaigns, both of which were successful on her side and were hugely significant for Irish society. Alva, first of all, how do you set out and launch a referendum campaign?
But I would say, first of all, very importantly, that you don't by any means necessarily start out with the aim of having a referendum. You set out with an issue that needs to be addressed, with a structural or systemic or specific problem that needs to be put right. And what you have to do is work out what are the best, most strategic means and ways to do that. Mm-hmm. And it may well be that a High Court case going on to the Supreme Court for adjudication, it may well be, if you take something like the water charges, that it's feet on the ground, encouraging people on the streets to put pressure on a government not to do something or to do something different. So there are many, many, many different kinds of campaigns. And the worst thing I think you can probably do at the very beginning of that process is to set out with some sort of set idea mm-hmm. as to what you need to do. There are many different kinds of campaign, and within every campaign there are many different elements. For example, you cannot really have a full-blown referendum campaign without feet on the street. Mm. We can't have it nowadays without an extremely savvy, smart social media campaign. Mm. You can't have it without lawyers endlessly deliberating on this, that and the other, although actually they put the people off, to tell you the truth. People don't like that.
You mentioned there being many different elements to a campaign. And I suppose having been at the centre of two very successful referenda campaigns in the last decade, would you say there's any particular elements or any secret recipe to winning a referendum?
Well, you know, that's the sort of question that those of us who are involved in appeal have been endlessly asked.
Yeah.
What is the secret? Of course, if there were some secret recipe, it wouldn't be secret. It would be out there in the public, mm-hmm. and the world would be a very different place, Ellen. But that's, unfortunately, there isn't. Some of the things that I think are very important are precisely the question of timing. When you see your moment, which is something that you probably know intuitively and instinctively as well as intellectually, when you see that moment, you absolutely have to seize it. You absolutely have to go and get it. For marriage equality, it was a moment which was produced by two people taking a High Court case. So they created that moment. And everything flowed then for marriage equality really from that case, that Gilligan and Zepponi case. It was very different for abortion. I mean, it was quite interesting before the death of Savita. As I said, some of us were thinking very hard and very strongly about how did we move this onto the agenda. But once her tragic death happened, there was such an outcry of public upset and distress and rage and anger. I mean, it was a kind of a mixture of anger and very deep regret and distress. And I think underneath all of that, there really was a strong sense of shame that this could happen to a young woman in our country. And it was very clear to me that when you get that level of emotional engagement with an issue, that's really, really, really important. Mm-hmm. And that's when you can, so to speak, make a move. But we were able to use those opportunities, if you like, along the line to push it forward. What's also very important is that you accept that even though this is about the Constitution, that if the arguments are only legal arguments, that people will not be able to engage with it. Constitutional issues tend to be about what people can and cannot do in their lives.
Yeah.
That's really what it's about. So if you keep it very legalistic, which had really happened in previous abortion referendums in particular, and in the first divorce referendum as well, it's really difficult for people to find their space. And I mean, legal argument is seen as being incomprehensible. So there are ways in which you have to move beyond these.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in marriage equality, personal stories were really very important. And again, similarly in the Repeal the Eighth campaign, the role of personal experience was important.
Mm.
Lobbying in our system, the lobbying of politicians is extremely important in relation to putting the issue onto the agenda in the first place. You have to, I think it's not about putting it onto the agenda. I always used to say to people, we have to heave this issue up onto the political agenda and put it there and keep it there and make sure that action is taken. So the first constituency that you have to convince in terms of referendum is actually the Oireachtas. But it actually does come out the other end vis-a-vis the electorate, the voters, because of course the TDs, you hope, are going back to their constituencies and saying, well, this is not such a frightening issue after all, or I'll support that group over there, or I'm prepared to speak out on that. And you find generally that if you get some kind of interested pool, if you can convince a number of TDs, that does give you an indication that you will also be able to speak to the people. But you have to really think about that. That's not something which is like an apple and just falls off the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that is contributing to enable you to talk directly with the voters.
Mm-hmm.
in a way that will engage them in their hearts. I mean, we talk about hearts and minds. We think of elections, whether they're, or we think of voting, whether it's in an election or a referendum, as being about making up your mind. In fact, it is at least as much, if not more, about where your heart is.
Looking to the future then, what do you think is the next big change that needs to be made to the Constitution?
Just on a very practical level, I mean, I think we do need to get rid of the women in the home. And that has been highly recommended by the Citizens' Assembly on gender, which was chaired by the excellent Catherine Day. I think that is a dinosauric article or clause in the Constitution that simply needs to be removed. I would love to see a referendum on there being a commitment to ensure that everyone has a home. Certainly an aspiration and a principle that everybody in our country should have an appropriate home.
Finally then, Alva, I want to ask you, in your experience, do you think that constitutional change is enough to establish societal change?
That question, is it enough to basically change the constitution? I would say that whenever you have finished a campaign, is that the end? And the answer is always no, even if it's not about constitutional change, because you're living in a state of constant evolution. But certainly in relation to repeal, I mean, it was perfectly clear that although there is now a legal right to abortion under restricted circumstances, first of all, the services that would enable the full enjoyment of those rights have not been fully put in place. And there are enormous difficulties for women, even within and the parameters of the law. And secondly, the law itself is not sufficient to meet the needs of all women and pregnant people who need abortion. So, you know, that is very hard work that has to go on. And the legislation is actually up for review now this autumn. So we are actually doing that work. In the case of marriage equality, you either have the right to marry or not. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't really a huge follow through from that. You didn't have to do very much. Whereas we knew with repeal that we were getting something out of the way and that putting in place the system that needed to be there is an enormous job of work. You could say, and I've always said, that the referendum was the easy part.
All there is to know about the Constitution goes so far beyond its 200 or so pages or this 30-minute documentary. But whether it's knowing how to defend what's in the Constitution, recognise the unenumerated rights that aren't, or use your power to change it through a referendum, I hope you feel more of a master of your Constitution. I'd like to thank my guests, Nora Ní Linshig, Conor O'Mahony and Alva Smith, and you for taking the time to listen. I've been Ellen O'Regan, and that's all for now.